Resurrected Republic, Truth Radio Broadcast, on RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network, because you can handle the truth.
Woo! Can you ever handle the truth? Resurrected Republic, Truth Radio Broadcast, I'm your host, Tom Lackabarra-Stewart. We just heard a wonderful interview by Chris Ann Hall, followed by a presentation into an area that Chris Ann doesn't cover. And the reason that I'm doing that, I'm not trying to mire the two together. Chris Ann Hall covers mostly the first, the Bill of Rights, first 10 amendments of the Constitution. She delves off into other areas briefly. And I can understand why it's been left to certain people to get a lot of egg on our face. You know the controversy that surrounds the 14th Amendment. Everybody who listens to this show, Resurrect the Republic, Dirty Uncle Sam, all the work that Bruce Ray Riggs and I have done, Thomas Maddox, and there have been many more who have purported that the real deep state, the true deep state, was created by Reconstruction and the 14th Amendment, and the jurisdiction created when that was done. The purported 14th Amendment to the United States Constitution is and should be held to be ineffective, invalid, null and void, and unconstitutional for the following reasons. One, the joint resolution proposing said amendment was not submitted to or adopted by a constitutional Congress according to Article 1, Section 3 and Article 5 of the U.S. Constitution. Two, the joint resolution was not submitted to the President for his approval under Article 1, Section 7. Three, the proposed 14th Amendment was rejected by more than one-fourth of all of the states then in the Union, and it was never ratified by three-fourths of the states in the Union, and actually there was ratification that was withdrawn prior to its order by many other states, Oregon and New Jersey and several others. So we're not talking about southern states, and we're not talking about against the reasons that people profess that it was forced into law, which was to create equality, which of course it never did. If that was the case, the civil rights movement never would have been a thing if it had done that. So we get to the unconstitutional Congress, and the United States Constitution provides under Article 1, Section 3, that the Senate of the United States shall not be composed of two senators from each state. Article 5 provides that no state without its consent shall be deprived of its equal suffrage in the Senate. The fact that 23 senators had been unlawfully excluded from the U.S. Senate in order to secure a two-thirds majority vote for adoption of the joint resolution, this is after the Civil War, after replacement governments have been put into place, and those representatives were rejected. They were disallowed from being seated. This is not a status of the Civil War. This is nothing about the Civil War. This was after the fact, after these states were lawful parts of the Union, according to the President, according to Congress at the time, prior to this happening. So they didn't have a two-thirds vote for adoption of the joint resolution proposing the 14th Amendment, shown by resolutions of protest adopted by the following state legislatures. One is the New Jersey legislature, by resolution of March 27, 1868, protested as follows. The said proposed amendment, not having yet received the assent of the three-fourths of the states, which is necessary to make it valid, the natural and constitutional right of this state to withdraw its assent, is undeniable. That it being necessary by the Constitution that every amendment to the same should be proposed by two-thirds of both houses of Congress, the authors of said proposition, for the purpose of securing the assent of the requisite majority, determined to and did exclude from the said two houses 80 representatives from 11 states of the Union upon the pretense that there were no such states in the Union after these states had already been accepted back into the Union, but finding that two-thirds of the remainder of the said houses could not be brought to assent to the said proposition, they deliberately formed and carried out the design of mutilating the integrity of the United States Senate, and without any pretext or justification other than the possession of the power without the right and impalpable violation of the Constitution, ejected a member of their own body representing this state, that's New Jersey, and thus practically denied to New Jersey its equal suffrage in the Senate, and thereby nominally secured the vote of two-thirds of the said houses, and this is under New Jersey Acts, March 27, 1868. And there's a reason why I'm including this content here. Chris Ann has a real strong presentation for constitutional issues. What I'm trying to explain is where I believe that the actual deep state was created. If we don't know the source and the origin of that deep state, we will be powerless to do a darn thing about it. And to understand that the unlawful jurisdiction that created this wide sweeping federal supremacy is part of the problem. This is what we really truly need to identify, right? So this is why I think that this is so important. The Alabama legislature protested against being deprived of representation in the Senate of the U.S. Congress. Arkansas, Georgia, Florida, South Carolina, North Carolina, New Jersey, Oregon. I mean, this is not just southern states. The northern states were opposed to this. So Article 1, Section 7 provides that not only every bill which shall have been passed by the House of Representatives and the Senate of the United States Congress, but that every order, resolution, or vote to which the concurrence of the Senate and House of Representatives may be necessary, except on a question of adjournment, shall be presented to the President of the United States, and before the same shall take effect, shall be approved by him, or being disapproved by him, shall be repassed by two-thirds of the Senate and House of Representatives according to the rules and the limitations prescribed in the case of a bill. Okay? And if you check out Chris Ann Hall's content on how a bill is made into law, that should be relevant there too. The joint resolution proposing the 14th Amendment, 14th Statute at Large, page 358, was never presented to the President of the United States for his approval, as President Andrew Johnson stated in his message on June 22, 1866. That can be found in Senate Journal, 39th Congress, First Session, page 563, and House Journal, page 889. So this is why I think this is a serious problem, because I think that identifying what the deep state is certainly relevant and important to the conversation. Now, the Constitution itself strikes the 14th Amendment with nullity. The defenders of the 14th Amendment contend that the U.S. Supreme Court finally decided upon its validity. Such is not the case. In what was considered to be the leading case, which is Coleman v. Miller, the Supreme Court did not uphold the validity of the 14th Amendment. In that case, the court brushed aside constitutional questions as though they did not exist. For instance, the court made the statement that the legislatures of Georgia, North Carolina, South Carolina had rejected the amendment in November and December in 1866. New governments were erected in those states and in others under the direction of Congress. The new legislatures ratified the amendment, that of North Carolina on July 4, 1868, that of South Carolina July 9, 1868, and that of Georgia on July 21, 1868. And the court gave no consideration to the fact that Georgia, North Carolina, or South Carolina were three of the original states of the Union with valid and existing constitutions on an equal footing with other original states, and those later admitted into the Union. So we have other problems. There's Hawke v. Smith, and there's so many, Dyett v. Turner. There's so many cases that we could cite. So I just wanted, I feel as though I would have neglected my responsibility to insert here the importance of knowing where the jurisdiction that was created, that created this deep state. Now we're in the modern era with all of their statutes, codes, and regulations that empower, enable them, and prevent them from being fired when they commit crimes such as hiring underage prostitutes or having their security clearance lifted quickly enough, or bad behavior, judges and bureaucrats that seem to be ensconced in Washington, D.C. and all over the states in that jurisdiction that was created by this Reconstruction. And in fact, if it was just a punishment on the 11 states, why was it subjected to all? That's a whole other portion of the debate. So anyway, for the rest of this broadcast, I do want to switch gears. I want to get back to an interview that was done. I think one of the best interviews that was done with Chris Ann was on C-SPAN. And I want to share that with you for the rest of tonight's broadcast, because if you have, especially if you have folks, if you have young people that are sitting around, grab them and sit them down and make them listen to this, because this information is so important. And we'll be sharing the full links and all of that on a publish on rtrtruthmedia.blogspot.com with all of the full links. We're probably not going to have time to run this next piece that I want to share with you in the time that we have. But there will be full links on the archives. There will be full links on rtrtruthmedia.blogspot.com when we post this archive sometime tonight or very early in the morning. You can go to rtrtruthmedia.blogspot.com. All the links to this will be there, including some of the information that I shared with you tonight regarding the 14th Amendment. So let's get to Chris Ann Hall on C-SPAN.
Author Chris Ann Hall, as we sit here in early August, how's President Trump doing?
Well, he's a president.
And?
Well, you know, I teach the Constitution as it was intended to be applied. And the presidents in America have operated outside the realm of their executive authority, constitutionally speaking, for decades. So to judge Trump, for me, is not to judge him against Obama or George W. Bush, but to use the Constitution as a standard. And sometimes he's good, sometimes not so much. And so that's how we view what goes on in Washington, D.C., not based on political party, not based on personality, but based on the standard by which all Americans should hold their federal government, the Constitution.
Well, when you use that measuring stick, which presidents, in your view, have adhered to the Constitution, which haven't?
Oh, it's been a long time. It's been a very, very long time since we've had a president that was truly constitutional. You look at Article 2 of the Constitution, and that that is the delegated authority for the executive branch. And when we look at that, we realize how little power the president has, especially autonomously, constitutionally speaking. I always show my students, you know, you look at the Constitution. Article 1 is the powers that are delegated to Congress. It's like this. Then you go to Article 2, delegated to the president. And then you go Article 3, delegated to the judiciary. And in America, we've gravitated more towards an all-consuming executive rather than an executive in service to the legislative. And what we have now in America is a bit of an aberration of what the president ought to be. And we think that the president is a leader of America. He is not the leader of America. He was never intended to be the leader of America. The president was intended to be an ambassador on behalf of the states in foreign affairs. And you can see that when you look at the powers that are delegated. The president is not the designator of war. He is not the controller of our troops unless, constitutionally speaking, there has been a formal declaration of war by Congress. So you asked me which presidents, right? So we look, when was the last time we had a declaration of war by Congress? World War II. It means every military action that has been led by an executive since World War II has been unconstitutionally done so. And so we have a president is not allowed to make deals. He can only make treaties. Those treaties are only accepted as if they are confirmed by two-thirds of the Senate and are consistent, as Article 6, Section 2 of the Constitution demands, with the delegated authority of the executive or legislative branches. And so what we have then is this expansion of presidential power, which is contrary to the intent of the framers. Our framers made the president a very small position relative to the legislative on purpose. Alexander Hamilton wrote a paper we call Federalist Paper 69. There was a great deal of discussion about the office of the executive. The designers of our constitutional republic were concerned that they had just achieved an independence from a monarchy. They did not want to establish a new government and create a new monarchy. I mean, it was an option. I don't know how many people remember from their civics classes, but there was a point in time where people were actually begging George Washington to be king. So we were this close to being the Kingdom of America. But our founder said, you know, we don't want to go back to the kingdom system again. Let's do the constitutional republic. But how do we ensure that the executive does not transmute over time into a king? And so the Federalist Papers 69 is a great source and understanding of not only what the power of the executive branch is, but why it's so very limited.
How did we get to the point then of executive orders and no war declaration since World War II? Is it Congress's fault?
Well, ultimately, it rests on the people. Samuel Adams said, "No people will tamely surrender their liberties nor be easily subdued when knowledge is diffused and virtue is preserved." He said, "But on the contrary, when the people become universally ignorant and debauched in their manners, they will sink underneath their own weight without the aid of foreign invaders." And what we've seen in America is a decline in the importance of the study of the proper role and placement of the federal government. And human nature dictates that people will gravitate towards a more powerful government to take care of their needs and to provide them with more comfort. And government will always accept more and more power. So Congress, yes, has a great deal of responsibility in the expansion of the power of the executive branch by unlawfully and constitutionally delegating authority to the president through through legislative acts. We have the people, though. A good example, the last presidential election. If I have a radio show and a television show, and what I did was I took six presidential candidates that spanned all, you know, the parties. We had the Green Party, we had independents, we had Republicans, Democrats, Libertarian. And so what I did was I took their published platforms and I didn't compare them with each other, as is popular. What I did was I compared each of their platforms individually to the constitutional role of the president. And what I found was that the promises that the presidential candidates were making are promises outside of the authority of the office of the executive. So the president does not have the authority to raise or lower taxes. That is a power reserved to the House of Representatives. The president cannot take care of our troops financially. He cannot expand troops. He cannot withdraw troops. That is the office, or that is a power reserved to the legislative branch. And what I realize is that all of the promises the presidents were making were responses to questions asked by the people. Will you do this for us? I mean, that's what the whole website thing is. Yes, we will do this for you. I will do this. I'm making this promise. But I think if the people were better educated, better understanding of the proper role of the executive, we would ask better questions that are in tune with the delegated authorities of the president. So in that vein, I think presidents become who the people want them to be.
From your most recent book, Sovereign Duty, you write, and if you'll explain this, the central government as a creation of the Constitution is not and cannot be a party to the Constitution. Let me say that again so that you don't miss it. The central government is not a party to the contract. It is a creation of the
Yes, it is a creation of the contract. Folks, we'll be right back after a few words from our sponsors where we'll be taking some calls. 1-800-313-9443, Resurrect the Republic, Truth Radio Broadcast.
with Chris Ann Hall tonight. We'll be right back.
Homeowners, are you in foreclosure, expecting to be served with a foreclosure lawsuit, or suspect your lender has coerced you into an illegal mortgage transaction? A huge number of mortgages made in the last 10 years have legal issues and are possibly defective. State laws and the U.S. Supreme Court have upheld that defective mortgage documents are grounds for foreclosure defense and for counterclaims in favor of the homeowner. If your mortgage has been sold or assigned since closing the loan, it may be defective and you may be paying the wrong party, and the lender may not have standing or the right to foreclose or collect payments under the law. If you would like to know if your mortgage is legal or not, or know if you are paying the right party, we can help. Our initial consultations are free of charge. We are not attorneys. We are legal researchers and work closely with experienced lawyers who know how to help you find the evidence to help you keep your home. Call toll-free 1-855-2-KEEP-IT. That's 1-855-2-KEEP-IT today.
Folks, we're living in a world the likes of which we've never perceived any clearer than we do now. The plan for global governance has been in the works for generations and would have likely been achieved by now but for the fact that the globalists left open their Achilles heel. With all their tools, Federal Reserve System, fiat currency, No Child Left Behind, and then Common Core education introduced to our schools to dumb us down, vaccines, pharmaceuticals to lobotomize us, GMO foods, insertion of compromised or bought and paid for politicians, judges, mainstream media propaganda, all pieced together like a puzzle designed to ultimately bring the world under submission. But with all their strategy, they forgot one thing: knowledge. And knowledge is power. With knowledge, their bombardment is nullified. Folks, with that, as brilliant and knowledgeable as you've become, among the wisest audience of any radio audience in the world, and you are, I want you to take a moment to reflect and ask yourself, how much of that knowledge did I obtain from Republic Broadcasting Network? How high has my consciousness been raised since I've been a listener? How fast am I now able to discriminate truth from fake news by being a Republic Broadcasting listener? How clear am I now able to see the world since I've been listening to RBN? Ask yourselves those questions, folks. Then ask yourself, what is that knowledge worth to me? Like my morning coffee, how would I survive without it? A voice of truth in a sea of lies. Do we not all need to make sure it survives? Like public broadcasting, we are now finding we can only survive with listener support. Censorship, advertisers being attacked, truth itself being attacked. It's the only way through this. We at Republic Broadcasting humbly ask you to become a supporter. Look at your budget and make a determination of what Republic Broadcasting is worth to you and what you can afford on a monthly basis. Go to republicbroadcasting.org and pledge 20, 30, 40, 50, if possible, 100 a month or more if it's affordable. Click the donate button and become a regular monthly donor. Assure both us and yourself that Republic Broadcasting truth will continue to flow like that morning coffee. The network thanks you.
Welcome back. Welcome back, Resurrect the Republic Truth Radio broadcast on RBN. Tonight's episode, it's dedicated basically to Chris Ann Hall and her work. We do still have Chris on the line, and we also have, when my machine starts working here, right, George in Texas. George in Texas, you're on Resurrect the Republic. Go ahead. Chris, hang back. George in Texas. I think we lost George in Texas. Is Chris still with us? Okay, this was something that we were supposed to check, but okay, not a big deal. We're going to continue on with the information. I'll always break in and let you guys comment if you want to call and comment, or you can just partake of the wonderful information we're sharing with you. This is Ms. Chris Ann Hall.
One thing that we need to remember about the formation of the federal government, and in the Sovereign Duty book and in the class that I teach on state sovereignty that you covered here on C-SPAN, we go through a whole timeline. The states are the first creation of the people, and that happened on July 2nd, 1776, with the ratification of the Lee Resolution. From the creation of the states through the authority of the people, the states came together and said, we need to form a confederation of states. We need to form a union for our mutual protection from foreign invaders. And we must form this union to be a unified voice in foreign affairs for treaties and commerce and peace and war and those kind of things. And we need to form an alliance between the states for a more peaceful interaction between the states. The states were formed as independent sovereign governments. When you read the writings of the designers of our Constitutional Republic through the Federalist Papers, the Anti-Federalist Papers, the ratification notes that James Madison took for the ratification debates, you see the terms state and nation played interchangeably. So when we speak of the state of Virginia, New Hampshire, Rhode Island, they also refer to Germany, France, and Spain as states as well. And so what we have to really understand is we created 13, at that time, independent sovereign governments with the same authority and political function as Germany, France, or Spain. And so they said, we need to come together and make this unified voice because we've looked through history, we've looked how Europe works, we need to fix the things that are not right over there.
So, George in Texas. George, you're on Resurrected Republic. Well, you know, it's either we possibly either have some technical issues or we have somebody trolling us, one or the other. I don't know which one they are, but he is a good guy. Okay, well, there he is, George. George in Texas, are you with us?
Yes, can you hear me?
Yeah, I almost thought I was being trolled there for a minute, man.
I got hung up on and all that stuff, but anyway, I remember, the 16th Amendment was never legally ratified, and certainly
right.
The 17th Amendment says we got 100 senators that are illegitimately sitting in the upper chamber. U.S. senators are not super congressmen. They are supposed to be ambassadors of the several states sent to D.C. as Washington, D.C., 10 square miles as neutral territory. And,
yep.
The thing is, if you look at, with the U.S. Senate, it's treaties, the selection of judges and Supreme Court justices,
mm-hmm.
Like I say, now it's more like special interest confirms the judges, and, you don't get no input from the state governments, this judge is bad for state rights. Or
yeah, yeah. You know, I look back to Judge Roy Moore, who knew more truth about some of these things that we're talking about than most other people all combined. I've heard him speak. And he was a good example of something that they had to prevent. He was fully aware of where and how the deep state was built. He was fully aware of the jurisdiction that was created to enable it. And there are people like that. He was one of the, he was a judge, but there are so many other people out there that are denied an opportunity to be able to fix any of this. But then again, we're in a two-party system now where there are aspects. Mostly, in my opinion, these conservative values are what's more correct, but there's aspects of both parties that are right and wrong. It's like a Hegelian schizophrenic split, and this is one of the reasons why Chris Ann and I both take the same approach, that we put principle over party. But hang on the line, George. We have to go into a break. We'll be right back after a few words from our sponsors, Resurrect the Republic, Dirty Uncle Sam, Truth Radio Broadcast, RTR Truth Media Reloaded.
You are tuned in to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Visit our website by going to republicbroadcasting.org.
Okay, nurse, let's get this man to the ER stat.
Right away, doctor.
We see this every day. Heart attack or angina pain due to blocked and clogged arteries. Chelation can remove obstructions or blockages from arteries and help avoid painful and expensive surgery. Now there's Angioprim. It's a liquid oral chelation product that you take with juice. You start to feel the results fast. Angioprim increases blood flow all over the body, and that means more energy and strength to take on the day with less aches and pains. 60 years of research has gone into chelation, and Angioprim is the result. A safe and easy way to unblock your veins and arteries from buildup that slow circulation.
Paging Dr. Jones, please report to the emergency room right away.
Log on now for a special radio offer from Angioprim. That's angioprim.com/radio. A-N-G-I-O-P-R-I-M. Angioprim.com/radio or call 877-882-7221. That's 877-882-7221.
Extendivite really works. Just listen to what some people have to say.
About 6 months ago, my wife bought Extendivite. She didn't tell me she was giving it to me. So after about 3 days, I said, maybe the weather's changed or something. I said, my legs feel really good. And she goes, well, I've been giving you this stuff, and it was the Extendivite. And you know that I'm about 75% better. I can actually climb stairs now, and I can get up out of chairs. I can even get down and, I got to work under a table or a computer table and work on a computer. I can actually get back up off the floor. You know what? It's an amazing product. I didn't think anything short of having surgery was going to help.
Extendivite is only $69.95 for a 2-month supply of either capsules or liquid. Call now. That's 1-877-928-8822 or visit heartdrop.com.
Extend your life with Extendovite.
Did you know that neither the American Medical Association nor the American Bar Association were established to benefit the American people? Have you recognized that in our country, health care has little to do with health, and that our court system has nothing to do with justice? The priests of both medicine and law have been incentivized to implement a dark agenda on behalf of the Bilderbergers and their ilk. To protect ourselves and our progeny, we need to take a much closer look at how these two giant industries really work. Join me, Al Whitney, on In Defense of Humanity, Saturdays at 7 p.m. Central, as we expose the matrix and learn how not to consent to our own destruction.
Welcome back, Resurrect the Republic Truth Radio broadcast on RBN. So, I don't know, Mike, if we ever got those little hiccups ironed out, but if anybody wants to call in and comment on anything that Chris Ann is talking about, please feel free to do so if you want. It's 1-800-313-9443. Until then, we're going to be running the rest of this amazing interview. Everybody who's already tuned in and already listened to the interview that we did with Chris Ann, you can share that. The archive will be on social media my Facebook page, at RBN's Facebook page, and on rtrtruthmedia.blogspot.com. We are still working on resurrectrepublic.com. That's why we're not publishing new articles there. But we are, in the meantime, using rtrtruthmedia.blogspot.com. Very interesting articles. Some aggregation from many different interesting sources. So I urge you to do that, as well as you can go to rtrtruthmedia.blogspot.com and click on that PayPal and send us some support. We'd appreciate that as well. So until then, let's get back to Chris Ann Hall on C-SPAN.
And through that, we will create a constitutional republic, bringing a confederation of the states, and then the Constitution itself will create the federal government. So the federal government did not exist until the Constitution was ratified. Not only that, there was a precarious moment prior to the ratification of our current Constitution where we didn't have enough states to ratify. It was a pretty scary moment for those who were designing the Constitution to think we might just not even have a union at all. And if that were to happen and the Constitution were not ratified, then there would be no federal government. So what we also have to realize is that the Constitution is a contract. Now, contract law speaking, when you have a contract, you have the parties to the contract. The parties of the contract are the people who come together to make the terms of the contract, they negotiate the terms, they design the contract, and ultimately sign the contract into legal being. In our constitutional republic, the states are the parties to that contract. There are some who teach that the Constitution is an agreement between the people and the federal government. That is not true. It can't be true. And we can show that to be false by one simple fact. How was the Constitution ratified? Was it ratified by popular vote? No. It was ratified by 3/4 of the states. So the states being the ratifiers of the Constitution mean that they are the parties. Some also try to teach that the Constitution is an agreement between the states and the federal government. That is a temporal impossibility, because the federal government did not exist until the Constitution was ratified. You cannot be the party to a contract when you are the product of the contract, because you cannot sign the contract into legal being until the contract, if you don't exist until the contract is already signed. So the only parties that existed that could be the creators of the Constitution are the states. And the federal government did not exist until the Constitution was ratified, which makes them the product. So the states are the creators of the Constitution. The Constitution created the federal government. Therefore, the states are the creators of the federal government.
So July 2nd, 1776 to what? September 1783?
1787.
87, mm-hmm. When the Constitution was finally ratified.
Well, we had the Articles of Confederation in between there, but they proved to be faulty on several aspects. One of the, when you read the notes to the ratification debates and the correspondences that they had with each other, you learn that the greatest difficulty, the greatest problem that they had with the original Articles of Confederation was that the federal government was operating outside of its boundaries, and it didn't have enough direction. So the greatest problem that we were having at that time was that the federal government was making inequitable treaties. So what they were doing was they were making treaties with foreign governments in which one state or one set of states had to provide all of the resources, and then a separate state or a separate set of states got all the benefit. So the states, having just now formed this union with this understanding that it's supposed to be mutually beneficial, who are having to foot the entire bill, were like, wait a minute, you know, this is not why we signed up for this, to transfer our wealth to another state. So we are not going to comply with this treaty, which is a really big deal. Because not only is a treaty an agreement, it's a contract with a foreign government. So our states who were refusing to comply with these foreign treaties, and they were righteously resisting because the treaties were inequitable for the members of the states, were making the foreign government mad for breaking the terms of the contract, plus the states that were supposed to get the benefit were mad at the states who wouldn't pay. So we have a problem now in the Articles of Confederation. Our confederation's about to split, and we just got started because we're about to go to war between the states on conflict. We're about to go to war with foreign governments, which is why we brought together the new convention to create our constitution, which is why our new constitution is called the More Perfect Union. So when we dissolve the Articles of Confederation, there is no more federal government. And the only governments that exist are the states. And there would have never been a new federal government had not our current constitution been ratified.
From your book, Not a Living, Breathing Document, Reclaiming Our Constitution, which was published in 2011, you write, "A common refrain these days is that we fell asleep. What that means is that our ignorance of the history that brought us our American liberty allowed tyranny to sneak up on us. However, that was not the case for our founders."
When we take the big picture, and I mean the full scope of the history of our American Constitutional Republic, we have to realize that it didn't begin in 1787. That liberty was not invented in 1776, and tyranny was not invented by George III. And when I teach a class called The Genealogy of the Constitution, which is covered in the Not a Living, Breathing Document book, what we do is we take the 700 years of history that give us our Declaration of Independence, our Constitution, and our Bill of Rights. And it is this history that proves to us that our Constitution is built upon time-tested principles, axiomatic truths. They are not inventions. Because when you know that history, you know there are five documents that were written. They are called the British Liberty Charters. And within those five documents, you find every single aspect of our Declaration of Independence, our Constitution, and our Bill of Rights. Not even just in principle, sometimes in the very language themselves, just taken from those documents and supplanted. We didn't invent anything in our foundational documents. We inherited everything. And it is that history that proves to us that our founders actually, and this is what may surprise some people, which surprises everybody who attends this class or reads that book, is that there is nothing new in America. This is not a brave new world. There's a popular belief that the Constitution is irrelevant, inapplicable to today, because, you know, our founders couldn't know what we're possibly seeing today. But when you study that history, you see that we are just repeating the same scenarios over and over again throughout time, even today.
Yes, even today. We are certainly still repeating this over and over again. So we have a few callers on the line. Rhonda, you're on Resurrect the Republic.
Hi, Tom. How are you doing tonight?
Oh, I'm blessed to be here, and we're struggling through some tech issues. But other than that, I don't know. Maybe I ticked somebody off in the federal government somewhere.
Well, you know what? I know you're playing, because I listened to you last night, and you had some technical difficulties, so I know it's a recording, right?
Yeah, unfortunately.
Let me just tell you something about contracts, okay? Let me tell you something about contracts. This is how Rhonda woke up this morning, and not to be too intimate or personal. Let me just tell you how I woke up this morning. I'm like, I woke up to the telephone call from a certain bank that issued me a credit card, okay? Mm-hmm. And they said, I had overdrawn my bank account, so when am I going to make a payment? And I was like, what are you talking about? That's how I woke up this morning, Tom.
Well, and that's like, always lovely, isn't it?
my credit card is, I never activated that credit card, so I said, y'all better figure it out. It's a fraud thing. I said, y'all better figure it out, because I never charged anything to that card. It was never activated. So you tell me, I don't have a bank account with you. I don't have a checking account or a savings account. So you tell me how that went to that credit card. You tell me. Well, we'll do it in a letter. Okay, well, thanks. You're not going to ruin my credit rating in the meantime, are you? No. Okay. Well, then, I'm a recruiter. I'm not going to tell you what industry, because that would just blow it. But I'm a recruiter. I had a kind of a verbal, written kind of contract. Contracts don't work, Tom. They don't work. Mm-hmm. There's always a loophole. There's always a loophole. So the second thing I got, I woke up to you owe us $150 from a bank. Then the second thing, I was working on a search for like 2.5 weeks, and I just learned that we had two great candidates, and they said to me, or the person I work with said, they hired somebody on their own. Contracts don't work, Tom. They don't work. So, Rhonda, and tomorrow I'm going to wake up and I'm going to find that person that they hired another job.
That's well, how that I works. I would say that some contracts don't work if you go into them, and that is provided that you even entered a contract, because it sounds like you had. This sounds like identity theft. But,
well, we did.
But,
we did we reduced the fee. Here's the thing, Tom. We normally do $15,000 for the search. We reduced it to $10,000.
Right.
And then we spread it out. We said, okay, now I make a quarter of that. So we spread the payments out. So I make $12.50 and then $12.50. That is a lot of work. We had two great candidates and these Yahoos. They just blew us out of the water, so we found somebody on our own.
No, I'm getting a little confused now. We're talking about the contract that bound you to...
Yeah, well,
or at
the
least
contract
in...
that we made, they don't work. There's always a loophole in contracts.
Did you read,
that's my whole
did
point,
you read
Tom.
The contract, and do you know what the loophole was that they used against you?
Well, it was a good faith effort, because we did a search for them in the past, okay? And unfortunately, the person I work with took it upon a verbal, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You got to have everything in writing, apparently. But, you know, then, you know what? Then they say, here's what they do, Tom. They say, you know, when I threaten to quit my job,
mm-hmm.
and my boss mentioned that, the hiring manager goes, don't make it emotional. Don't bring emotion into it. It's like, what are you talking about, stupid? You know, you just want to slap them because, you know, you have two great candidates, and then they, you know that they're already cheap because they already downgraded your fee agreement to $5,000 less than you normally make. But you have a working relationship with them, Tom, so what do? You think they're going to be honest? Of course.
Well, I would have
contracts
to...
Contracts are complicated.
Well, they are complicated. I would not say that they're not enforceable. I can say that the lawyerly twists and turns that are made often deceive people into a different idea of what a contract stands for. But it really comes down to being informed prior to your signing something. And... You know, I've had this argument. I go back and forth with my wife on this, and I said, you know, this isn't the way it was supposed to be. The normal, common, everyday man should be able to navigate society without all of these twists and turns and deceptions. And really, it is. It's a kind of deceitful way of getting things by people through some of this, the way these contracts are worded. But it's really about taking that signature prior to your signing it, and really fully knowing. See, people oftentimes they're trying to get a job, they're trying to do whatever, so they don't read the fine print of the things that they're signing, and then often they find themselves right in a moral sense, but then wrong in a legal sense. Does that make sense?
Well, absolutely, Tom. You're right on my page. Because I am a Christian, right? As you are, I know you are.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So I work my butt off, and guess what? And here's the thing. I don't get paid unless we get paid. It's kind of an agreement I have with somebody. So we have an agreement, and contracts don't work, because then when you tell the hiring manager that I went out of the box because they're cheap, they are cheap, 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 and they say, we hired somebody else on our own.
Yep.
And then you say, to them, well, a recruiter that I've had on my staff for 15 years is getting ready to quit because I can't pay her unless you pay me. And then they reply and they go, don't make it emotional.
Yeah,
I get it. Don't bring emotion into it.
I get it.
It's like,
you
are
know,
you kidding me?
So I'm just sending some...
Here's the thing, Tom. I'm a Christian, but I'm sending some bad karma out to that company.
No. Pray for them.
No, I am.
Pray for them.
Praying for his stupid butt, because, you know, that's just... He's a stupid ass.
I get it. No,
but
I get it.
It's so frustrating. But when Chris Ann Hall in your interview was talking about contracts,
mm-hmm.
I'm like, let me tell you about contracts. Even if you have a great working relationship, throw you under the bus.
No, I get that. I get it, but it really does come down to, and I don't mean this to sound harsh to anyone, but it really comes down to being fully responsible in knowing exactly what it is you're signing, and also having the wherewithal to say no. When you find something that may be able to be turned against you. In fact, I would advise you, and I hate to say this, but before you enter into any more contracts with anyone, I would recommend that you have somebody read that said contract very carefully and explain it to you before you sign it. Because when you put your name to that paper and you sign, you are, by your own consent, agreeing to everything that could be argued within the body of that contract. So if you want to, and you can, by the way, add supplementals to contracts. Now, companies don't have to accept them. They don't have to hire you based on your supplemental or your changing. You could always change the contract before you sign it. But once you sign it, once you put your name on it, then you're kind of locked into it, and if you went into it ill-informed or not fully informed, you know, Benjamin Franklin said, we're going to give you a republic if you can keep it. Well, one of the requisite parts of being able to keep it is to be fully advised and informed and responsible for all of your decisions. It's rough, because we know what these attorneys do. I get it. But I think that your situation is a lesson in why if you're not fully, like, this already happened, so it would make sense to me, before you enter into any other contracts with anyone, to please have somebody who understands contracts read it and explain it to you in detail before you're willing to sign it.
Well, that's the thing. We took them on good faith effort because we'd done a placement with them before.
Yeah, that never works out.
No, it doesn't. And you know what? He just ruined it. And you know what? When the person I work with threatened to say that his senior recruiter threatened to quit.
When you said you took it upon good faith, where was your faith being placed?
It's because we had a successful placement with them in the previous 5 months.
Uh-huh.
So placement. Good faith effort, placement fee.
Right.
Okay,
right.
So we already undercut our fee, right? Recruiters, you know, these people don't realize. And LinkedIn, damn it, LinkedIn is a blessing and a curse. I hate LinkedIn. I like LinkedIn, but I hate them.
Yeah, I used to.
And that's the thing, Tom. Is that this technology is ruining my life. It's ruining my life.
Unplug from
because
the system.
You know what?
That'll never hurt you. That'll never hurt to
you
unplug.
You know what, Tom? Here's my point. And yeah. I know you can appreciate this. Is that there is nothing, in my opinion, there is nothing more valuable in a work relationship, in a working relationship, than a one-on-one, me and you talking, okay? When the millennials, okay, so you and me talking, that's valuable, one-on-one. We're talking. We're having a conversation. My problem is, Tom, is when you're on LinkedIn and you try to reach those millennials, which is what I'm doing because these are junior jobs, all they want to know is, what company is it? It's like, call me and I'll tell you. They are afraid of the phone. They're afraid of the social media has taken over, Tom. We're getting shafted. They
social
don't
want to
have a conversation.
Yes,
right?
Sir. Yes. Social engineering is a real problem.
It is. So I've been a victim of it myself.
They purged my YouTube channel and they shadow banned my Facebook. Goes, I have 5,000 friends and all kinds of followers, and I'll make a post and I'll get 3 thumbs up. That's obviously, it's obvious what they're doing.
It's a curse. It's a blessing and a curse in the same way, because you
can
reach people,
wasting their time.
It gets people wasting their time. It costs a fortune. It costs a fortune. Yeah. Fortune.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And somebody I know called up and said, you've ruined my business. And they said, not everybody can get on the phone like I do. And I do. I call into the radio shows. I used to be really shy, but I call into radio shows
and just
speak my mind.
That's why we're here.
Yeah, I know. Right. And you know, I was like the shyest person. I would have told you never would I call into a radio show. But then I took speech class. I got comfortable in my own skin, kind of blah, 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 this and that. But I have some grievances, Tom. And one is contracts. One is the social media thing. I can't get people to call me. You know, they want to know the company. It's like the whole thing. I can tell you in 2013, 12 and 13 is when my life changed, because, you know, that's when it really started kicking in with LinkedIn. And they're like, they make millions of dollars, and they're good for contacting people, but these millennials better get on a stick and start talking, because
they're learning.
You can't have a conversation with an email or a text. And
all
that
I think we're losing it.
I think we need to get back to the whole one-on-one thing, because it is so important to be able to speak to people. And that's weird, because the whole job that I'm searching for them, they have to be on the phone all damn day.
Well,
anyway,
Tom, I
just wanted to, you know, your guest mentioned contracts, and I realized, you know, you got to get an ironclad contract, but it just bothers me when people down, you know, I told somebody that I work with, I said, I am not going to be a doormat anymore. I said,
Rhonda,
we're going to expect more, and we're going to get it. Yeah.
I appreciate your call. We're out of time.
Resurrect
the Republic. Thank you for calling Resurrect the Republic Truth Radio broadcast on RBN. Thanks for tuning in tonight. We'll be back with some very interesting stories and news tomorrow night. God bless you all. Resurrect the Republic Truth Radio broadcast on RBN.
Tired of being lied to by mass media? It's growing more and more apparent today that news is received less and less through standard media outlets, even with a growing audience every day. RBN is beginning to direct more efforts into social media. Social media and the use of the internet is fast becoming the primary source of people for news, regardless of demographic. RBN has set out to provide some of the best news on the internet through republicbroadcasting.org, and also has begun to use the tools to our advantage by way of social media. Republic Broadcasting is now operating a Facebook Facebook page to function as yet another avenue to have our collective voice reach new audiences across not only America, but across the globe as well. The Facebook page features not only news, but also an RBN player to listen to our broadcast. Get involved by visiting facebook.com/republicbroadcasting and liking our page and share it with your friends and family, because you can handle the truth.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network, because you can handle the truth.